Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part one of today's program, a look at what it might be behind at least some people's religious fervor. And in part two of today's program, out of the archives, a conversation with one of the granddaughters, Mahatma Gandhi. Stay with us. It isn't all that often that we talk about religion on the morning show. We're going to be talking about religion today and viewing religion through a very intriguing prism. We're going to be speaking with a psychologist by the name of Stephen Reese, who has also been a professor of psychology both at the University of Illinois at Chicago and Ohio State University. The author of several intriguing books, the most recent of which, just published, is called The 16 Strivings for God, The New Psychology of Religious Experiences. In this book, Stephen Reese explores what are some of the most fundamental sort of human longings that all of us have, all of us share, those needs which all of us to varying extents experience as human beings. And those things we long for, strive for, figure in the religious life which many people experience or choose. And it is Stephen Reese's contention that who we are and what particular strivings or needs or hungers are most important to us probably has a lot to do then with the religious path or the religious practice which we choose, or if we choose one at all. And it is an intriguing notion and one which has never been explored exactly in this way. And so I'm very excited to be able to speak with Stephen Reese about his intriguing book, again called The 16 Strivings for God, The New Psychology of Religious Experiences, published by Mercer University Press. Stephen Reese, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
Glad we can have this this conversation. Let's begin in a place that I hope won't be too personal a question. Did you come to this question of what drives us, so many of us, to be religious? Did you come to this from the perspective of someone who, for whom religion and religious practice is important, or is this entirely an objective exploration for you, more as an outsider looking in, trying to understand what is at the heart of most persons' encounter with religion?
Well, my primary interest here is to understand religion. I'm not trying to promote it or to criticize it. So I'm looking at what makes us tick. And in order to understand that as a behavioral scientist, I think we need to understand spirituality and religion. So that was the main reason that I looked at it.
I'm just curious, is it something which had occurred to you that you had wondered about yourself personally before this on a more personal level, or pretty much is this entirely a professional pursuit, a professional question you were addressing?
It's not entirely a professional pursuit. It was mostly a professional pursuit that got me to study it. You know, of course, I have my own religion, but one of the things that's really true about spirituality and religion is that we're really different. What makes one person spiritual and religious, the opposite could be true for someone else. And so the old introspective model, where you look inside yourself, discover why, say, you're religious or what's meaningful to you, That tells you maybe a little bit about yourself, but it doesn't tell you about human nature, because other people could be the opposite, very, very different. And it is the fact that we're very different that poses great challenges for religion to become popular, and it's really at the core of social intercourse in so many different ways. We have very different values from each other.
Right. So in order for a major religion to take hold, to powerfully connect with a wide swath of people, it has to at least some extent, speak to a lot of different people who live with a very different set of values. And yet at the heart of this are 16 strivings, which you say all of us have to varying extents. We'll talk about that in a moment. Your book actually begins with a kind of a laundry list of various people who have written on the topic of religion, of where this hunger for religious experience perhaps comes from. And it is your contention that even though many of these people are impressive thinkers, that they are all, in a sense, making the mistake of being simplistic, of assuming that it is one or maybe two basic hungers that are at the root of why so many people are religious or seek out religious experience. It is your contention that it is a more complicated picture than that.
Exactly. Previous people just looked at one or two things, or they ended up saying one or two things are the key for understanding why people are religious. And actually, it's much broader than that. We find 16 basic desires or 16 meaningful, different kinds of meaningful experiences in religion. So I think it has been way too narrow.
One of the contentions of your book, something you explore, is the fact that when it comes to what are those basic hungers, those basic strivings that all human beings, at least to some extent, share, there's been some difference of opinion about the best way to explore that. And evidently, there are plenty of people in the field who believe that people themselves are, in a sense, maybe too close to their own desires to understand them and to be able to articulate them. Or maybe people are too prone to whitewash what their desires are and to not be completely honest. You took a very different tack from that, that the best way to study what drives us as human beings is not to sort of look from the outside in objectively at witness behavior, but to ask people very directly, what is most important to you? What do you value most? Talk a moment about that difference of opinion and what leads you to feel so strongly that the best way to study this, to ascertain exactly what people's hungers are, is to ask them directly.
The other thinkers before us, you know, they did things like they went to New Guinea and they studied primitive tribes to discover the primal nature of the human being, where they gave ink blots and they did projective, you know, assessments to study the unconscious mind. We just asked people directly. We thought of everything somebody could want, everything that could move you, and we asked people which ones actually do. And by now we've questioned over 100,000 people from many cultures in different continents, and we find that everything people say they want that could have any significance to their lives reduces to 16 basic desires. And these basic desires play out throughout all life. They're in relationships, they're in business, they're in sports, they're in education. And in this new book, we show these desires are really in religion. They're all over religion.
Say a word more about exactly how you went about doing this, exploring this. What exactly were the questions that you posed to all these different people? How were those questions posed? And to whom were you posing these questions? I mean, how did you find the people to whom you were directing these questions? And to what extent can you be certain that they were a representative swath of the human population?
Okay. The questions are things like, I enjoy parties. I love to go to parties. Going to parties are the most important thing, you know, in my life. And we ask people if they agree or disagree so that we get variations on things like socializing. It's important to me to understand things. Everyone would say yes to that. So we would ask a question like, understanding things is essential to my happiness. Not everyone agrees with that. Playing sports is the most important thing in my life. Questions like this. We thought of everything we could think of. And then we asked everybody who would tolerate us, and we went through all the psychology books, and we got a list of everything we could imagine that somebody might want, that might motivate somebody. And then we worded them in ways that people would disagree as to how much they're motivated by it. And we started asking, college students, and we asked many people from the business world. We've asked athletes. We've had many students in schools. So at this point, it's a very broad representative. I don't know if it's representative. It's a very broad group of people, and they come from Europe, from Asia, and from North America. Now, this is the list of 16 desires is over 15 years old. And, you know, so there's a challenge out there. Think of something we left out. No one has come up with anything that's left out. So someone may in the future, I can't rule that out, but this is a very comprehensive list of what moves us.
And just say a word about the concern that has been raised by some of your colleagues that when someone is asked, you know, what is most important to you, there are at least some people who would really be inclined to say, oh, well, I want to strive for world peace or the well-being of others or whatever, and might really be reluctant to admit that, well, yeah, I'm really hungry for fame, or I really want to be rich, or whatever it might be, human beings can sometimes have an extraordinary capacity for dishonesty when it comes to ourselves.
Right. So psychologists don't agree on much, but they really don't value asking people questions. The Freudians think, well, you know, everything's unconscious, so you don't know the answer. The behaviorists think that the answers are mentalistic and don't even exist. And the social psychologists, you know, think people might be just trying to say things positively. We asked people, the initial research, it was anonymous. It was obviously anonymous. People understood there was no way we could connect them to their answers. So there's no advantage to them to fake the answer to it. Also, many people are proud of their answers. And, as long as they think you can't use the information against them, they will tell you what's more or less true. Now, we took the 16 desires and we validated it. We show that how you value these desires, everyone wants the same 16 things, but people value differently. And how you value them predicts like your college major, it predicts your relationships, it predicts your job satisfaction, it predicts a lot of things about people, so they must be mostly telling us the truth. Of course, there's going to be some distortion. There always is in science. But these 16 desires, once you learn what they are, they're all over the place. We have over 1,500 people practicing this in terms of, you know, using the desires to counsel people and to motivate people. So we know that the method is mostly valid. And the new book shows a real close correspondence between how you value these desires and religion.
We're speaking with Stephen Reese about a new book he's written called The 16 Strivings for God, The New Psychology of Religious Experiences. In this book, he outlines what he has determined to be the 16 essential strivings that all of us as human beings have. And then he has gone on to examine the way in which various kinds of religions or various forms of religious practice speak to those various kinds of strivings, and that how someone with a certain array of strivings, where certain strivings are particularly important, will then in turn be likely drawn to a particular kind of religious practice. And it's a very, very intriguing notion explored in meticulous detail. So, Stephen Rees, maybe we should, as we continue into some specifics, talk about what these 16 strivings are. I don't think we need a thorough discussion of each, of course, but maybe you can just kind of list them off and maybe say a word about how difficult it was to arrive at this particular list. Were you tempted to make it longer? Were you tempted to make it shorter? Was it difficult to arrive at what was ultimately the final list from which you build the rest of your book?
Okay. Well, the 16 desires are acceptance. We all are motivated to be praised rather than criticized. Understanding. Everybody wants to understand things rather than be confused. Eating, of course. Family. Raising children. Honor. Character. Idealism. Fairness and social justice. Everyone has a sense of fairness. How independent or self-reliant you are, structure, order, physical activity, competence, power, romance, saving, socializing and belonging, status, which desire for respect, tranquility, desire for safety and vengeance, the desire to get even with people or confront them. Every human motive seems to be one of these, fall under one of these 16, or is some combination of 16. Now, people have suggested that we left this out and we left that out, but as we examine the suggestions, we find that almost nothing is left out. So, for example, what about money? You know, people are motivated to money. What's that about? Psychologically, that's about status. What about creativity? Well, people are not motive. It's not a universal motive. Everybody's not trying to be, to be creative. And then, of course, we were initially criticized. We left out spirituality, and that's what the new book does. It shows that spirituality is all 16 of these desires, and we didn't leave that out at all. So we are always looking at, well, did we leave something out? And there's very little left out.
So one of the most intriguing notions in your book is the idea that for some people we are, for a given person, there are certain strivings or desires that are very strong, and that then there are other strivings and desires for that same person that are weak, but that all of us have all 16. All of us strive for all 16 of these things, but for us, some of the strivings are stronger than others. And that, of course, ends up being a kind of a complicating factor then in understanding how a given person's religious life might play out. Talk for a moment about the importance of the stronger versus weaker desires, and help us understand the importance of including that in the mix.
Right. That is the essential new idea in this whole work. Everybody wants the same thing. Everyone is motivated by the same things, like respect and understanding and belonging. And because of that, many psychologists and researchers and thinkers have thought, well, motivation is not that important because we all want the same things. But what we have, the way we look at this is, although everybody wants the same things, we value them differently. So everyone wants to understand, but some people value understanding much more than others. Everyone wants order, but some people value order more than others. Everyone wants to belong, but extroverts put a very high value on belonging. Introverts put a low value on belonging. So in order to understand motivation, you need to look at two things: what people want, which is the same, and how much they want, which varies enormously from one person to another. And the key to predicting their behavior, and the key is how much they want, is looking at both of these things. And when you look at both, when you look at how you value these 16 desires, it corresponds very closely to what the person likes and doesn't like about religion. Religion is addresses both the strong and the weak form of each of the desires. So, you know, religion is presented with people who are extroverts who find meaning in belonging, and people who are introverts who find meaning in meditation and solitude. So what does it do? Does it say God blesses belonging? God says God is not for people who want to go off on their own and be alone? No, it doesn't say that. I mean, logically it might. But if it did that, only extroverts would be going to church. So what religion does is it tracks the contradictions of human nature. It says God blesses fellowship, God blesses meditation and solitude. There's a home for the extrovert. There's a home. Religion offers a home for the introvert. We come in opposites. With respect to each of these 16 things, we are opposites. One person's an achiever. Another is laid back. Religion has to bless both. It has to bless the laid-back person who values submission and the achiever who values power and leadership and control. And it does. And that's basically what the book shows, is that everything in religion divides into one of these 16 desires in strong form, highly valued form, or in weak form.
So in a sense, you're helping to explain the amazing diversity of religions across the planet, because each one, in a sense, tends to speak to a particular array of desires and values.
Exactly. Hinduism, for example, something, you know, I place low value on status. I never, from the moment I heard of Hinduism and the caste system, not so much Hinduism, the moment I heard of the caste system, I just reacted really negatively. Negatively avoiding it, not attracted to it in any way. Whereas Christianity is much more placing value on family. So if you look at the different religions, they don't value the 16 desires the same. And that's one of the reasons there's conflict between them, because it's partially a value conflict.
I want to ask you about a specific line in the book that left me a little puzzled. It's actually from the chapter 8. So at this point, you have explored most of these specific strivings and desires and longings and paired them up with various kinds of religious practice, helping us kind of, understand the diversity of what people experience and the diversity of what different kinds of people seek out. And in this last chapter, you write at one point, "We are particularly motivated to satisfy both our strong basic desires and our weak basic desires." At least on the surface, I don't quite understand that, because it seems like those things that are our weak desires are the things that we don't particularly care about. And it almost seems then that those shouldn't figure at all in the equation or not significantly. But it sounds like you're not saying that. You're saying that our weak desires also mean a lot to us. How can that be true?
Right. That's a very good question. Really good question. There are two points here. The first point is the easier point. We don't count average desires. I don't pay much attention to average desires. That's because I assume that average desires are satisfied by secular culture. That if you have an average need for, say, thinking, an average need for understanding, just going through life almost as a zombie will bombard you with enough intellectual activity that it'll satisfy an average desire. If you have a strong desire, you have to do something more than that. You have to be reading books, listening to radio shows, and really getting yourself kind of involved. And other people will see you as an intellectual. Now, what if you have a weak desire? What you want is just a little bit of understanding. And like, think of eating. Suppose you just want to eat a little bit. Right? What happens if you eat more than a little bit? You spit it out. So it's, that's the same notion, okay, with the second part of your question, why the low desire. People are motivated to maintain just a little bit. If they're low, they want just a little bit of understanding. And if you give them more, like you see in school with some kids, they start screaming, you know, in frustration because you're stimulating their intellect more than they're motivated to experience at a greater rate. If you take an introvert, you give them, they try to reduce their social contact. They're controlling their socializing to a low level. Now, it's not that they don't want nothing. They will be motivated if they go for long periods of time to alone. They will then be motivated to socialize. But if you give them, if you think, oh, socializing is wonderful, let me take you to a party, you will then discover the joys of socializing and you'll become an extrovert like me. That won't happen at all. They'll think, oh, no, you're trying to change me. You're contradicting my values. They will fight for meditation and solitude and to regulate their social contact down to a lower level. So from the point of view of human nature, we have people trying to socialize more than the culture makes it easy for them to do, and we have people trying to avoid, to be alone more than the culture is letting them do. And then we now introduce religion, which has to say you're both engaged in meaningful activities. The extrovert's doing something meaningful by socializing, and the introvert is doing something meaningful by meditating. And the only way to do that is you have to support contradictory values in different contexts. And then some people say, religion contradicts itself. Well, yeah, but that's because human nature is different. Religion is addressing individual differences in human nature, trying to create an inclusive home so that God can be for everybody.
In some ways, it seems like if we took this notion to its extreme, then various religions would be, in a sense, a little more monochromatic. That is, well, everybody who where this and this and this and this are important to them are all going to be over in this church, and everybody where this and this and this and this is important, they're going to be over in this church. And of course, the reality of modern religious life doesn't quite play out as neatly as that. Help us understand why, in fact, the way religious practice plays out does not always neatly align with what you have laid out here.
So each religion has something to offer both sides, and therefore tries to appeal to everybody. So they, on one hand, for the war, people have a warrior, combative personality. You have the wrath of God, and they can say, or you have jihad, depending on your religion. You know, say, well, you know, if the fighting spirit is good for God, you know, it's got to be validated in me. On the other hand, you have the peacekeepers. You have the people who find meaning in conflict avoidance, find meaning in creating in peace. And so for those people, you have turn the other cheek. And so you have both. And that's true with respect to each of these desires for almost all of them. So for, say, the basic desire for status, well, the highest status is God, divine rights. You have, the Pope is closest to God. You have status. But on the other hand, you have God blesses the poor. So for people like me who don't like status, who place an unusually low value on status, so I find great meaning and great respect for religion, are saying, at least the religions that say, God supports the downtrodden, the poor will inherit the earth. So that's the low-status people. But high-status people, they find that, they're going to reject that. So to get both of us into the church, the religion has both and lets us focus on any combination we want, any combination of high and low-status we want, any combination of ideas. And what the book shows is that particularly Judeo-Christian religions, do this carefully with respect to each of the 16 desires.
A last question. Who do you think is going to benefit most from understanding this? I mean, would a given religion, would a given congregation, in a sense, benefit, profit from having a greater understanding of this? Or is it important for individual people to understand this about themselves and their own religious practice? Or is that not at all the point of this book? And is the point simply an objective academic exploration, not really for the sake of anybody's or anything's betterment?
Well, the largest appeal in terms of numbers of people is that there's a correspondence between how you value the 16 desires and what you like or dislike about religion. So people who are interested in understanding their own personal spirituality, people who are interested in understanding what is meaningful in their life, can look at these 16 desires and see how they value them. This is actually a lot simpler to do than it may initially seem. We got this down to pretty easy to do. And once you know which ones are most important and less important to you, you then have you can then see why you're spiritual or why you are or aren't religious. And then you can make better decisions. When you understand yourself better and you understand what's really motivating you, you'll make better decisions with regard to religion, spirituality, and generally. So that, I think that's the most important thing. As far as the intellect, it's of interest, I think, intellectually, to people who just want to understand religion, from an intellectual standpoint. Everyone's thought about religion. A lot of people think that religion is about the fear of death. It obviously is not about the fear of death. If you were going to build a religion that reduced people's fear of death, you would have left out the fires of hell. The fires of hell increase people's fear, make them more afraid. So if you want to understand religion intellectually, I think the book is certainly for that audience too. But the largest audience, it would be an average religious person who wants to know how their values correspond to their religion and begin to see how different that is from other people. Because when we understand other people from ourselves, we become more tolerant, I think, and we lay the groundwork for inclusiveness. We understand why what's motivating people who are making very different choices from us. So the main thing is to understand yourself and maybe some of the people you know really well and how they relate to spirituality and religion. And that's about looking at the 16 desires and figuring out your own, how you value them as an individual.
The book again is called The 16 Strivings for God, The New Psychology of Religious Experience. It's published by Mercer University Press, the author Stephen Reese. Stephen Reese, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the really good question.
The time is 8:43. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. Part two of today's program is an excerpt from a memorable interview from The Morning Show archives. And here it is. And I'm not sure that I can find the adequate words to say how tremendously pleased and honored I am that in our studios we have today, as a very, very special guest, a granddaughter of Mahatma Gandhi, Usha Harish Gokhani. She is a social worker who works tirelessly on behalf of the downtrodden in her native land of India, and in so many meaningful ways is carrying on the legacy of her grandfather, one of history's most revered peacemakers, and also a great peacemaker and thinker who is as revered today as ever, and not only in India, but all around the world, including many people here in the United States who find themselves drawn to much of what Mahatma Gandhi said and wrote and did and stood for in his tireless quest for justice, and always doing so adhering to a very strict policy of nonviolence, an inspiration to many others who came after him, including, of course, America's own Martin Luther King. And Usha Harish Gokani has come to southeastern Wisconsin as the keynote speaker of a very special ceremony at Carthage College, which is the culminating event in a special peace observance. And we're very honored to have her here. Joining her, her traveling companion and Gandhi scholar, Prasad. And we're also happy to have with us Racine's own Mike Frontier, who paid a very memorable trip to India not long ago. He is in the studio as well. So a warm welcome to all three of you, and particularly to our very special guest, Usha Harish Gokani.
Thank you for the kind words. I don't think I deserve all these things which you have said. My grandfather, that was Gandhiji, Mahatma Gandhi, was really a great person. He did a lot, and single-handed he started, and gradually people started joining him. But after all, I am the granddaughter, so a little bit I get, because he is my grandfather, little praise. That is my privilege. So, but let me say that he was great. I am not that great. But yes, I'm trying to work for the underprivileged and the downtrodden, illiterate people, and children and women is my sphere of work. And accordingly, I'm attached to, as you very rightly said, to the Gandhian institutions also in various capacities, and which gives me tremendous pleasure. I feel very happy, and at least I feel what my grandfather did for the world, not only for the nation, at least a little bit I'm also doing in my own small way. And I think, as the Chinese proverb goes, journey of 1,000 miles also begins with one step. So with each drop of water, the whole sea is filled. So these are the sayings which gives me encouragement. Whatever little I'm doing may be a drop in the ocean, but I'm doing. And with full honesty and with full capacity. So that is my satisfaction.
Very good. Very beautifully put. I complimented you before we even began on how beautifully and elegantly you speak English, and you were telling me that that was something very important to your grandfather. I don't mean necessarily English, but something about whatever
language
you speak.
Yes.
Go ahead. What did he say?
He said, whichever language you speak, it should be in the right way. You should not misuse the words or the exact meaning, and don't mix up languages. If you are speaking your mother tongue, speak fully in that. Don't mix up any other outside in a sense, other than the mother tongue. And the same with English also. If you speak English, speak well. And his own English, I'm told, was considered to be Shakespearean English. Very correct and very nice.
It's almost as though he believed that the way you use a given language says something about the respect with which you hold maybe a given people.
Yes, that is true.
So you told me that you do have memories of your grandfather,
yes,
Mahatma Gandhi. Tell us what kind of memories you have. What first of all, how clear are your memories of him?
My memories are very vivid. Very distinctly I remember him, because I have spent nearly 8 hours in my young days up to the age of 8. There were more contact. I used to spend more time with my brother and sister and my parents, with him and my grandmother. I cannot forget my grandmother, because my grandmother was also a great lady, and for me, she was really a adorable grandmother. And she was so good, so kind. She used to pamper and spoil like all grandmothers they do. It's their privilege between the grandmothers. But my grandfather was, although he was very loving, he cared for us and about all round development. whether physical, mental. He used to be very observant, what sort of clothes we are wearing, whether it is coming in the way of our physical development. And my mother told me once that when my sister is the elder to me, she is Sumitra Kulkarni. So when she was born, he had cut the small, that baby frock for my sister and showed my mother that this sort of clothes are good for children. It should not hurt the children. They are very delicate. Their skin is so delicate. And for growth, it should be a very comfortable thing. So these minute things about cleanliness, he was very, very fussy about cleanliness. People, in the name of his simplicity, usually they mix up. They say, oh, this is a Gandhiji's work. It will do, even if it is not very particularly sort of artistic or simple, but elegant. But he was very particular. His mud cottage, which is in one of his communes, name is Sevagram Ashram. That is in central India. And that was his third commune he had established in India. Otherwise, in South Africa, it was Tolstoy Farm also in Phoenix.
So if we would walk in there, we would see something that was very, very clean and very, very neat?
Very neat, and his mud cottage was so artistic that there was, even in the mud, they have made a design of a village with a cottage, a river just coming down, flowing down, and then trees, coconut trees and the palm trees. So it's a beautiful, and he was that way. I won't call him that sort of a religious, a staunch religion for the sake of that in the name of religion, there has to be some rituals. He was not that sort of a ritual-minded person, but he had great faith in God. And that's why, even though he had no time in his later years, once he was engrossed in keeping people, creating that awareness and that freedom struggle, and to negotiate with the rulers, that is the British people, the viceroys and prime minister and whatnot. So, but even then, morning and evening prayers was a must. He said, he used to tell that as food is important for your body, the same way prayers are for your soul. And God is the one that he has immense faith in God. He said that he is the one, without his will, not even this leaf will move. And he used to say, once I remember, I'm just jumping. In 47, when we became independent, our first home minister, Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel, was our first home minister. He was in charge of the security also. So he must be getting some news that people are after Gandhiji's life. There are some disgruntled people who want to kill him. So once he told, Bapuji, I want to keep some security for you because your life seems to be in danger. He said, when I go to the prayer meeting or any meeting, if with that fear if I'm going, then my mind will be disturbed. And that means I don't have faith in God. And he is the savior. If he wants to retain, means give me life, nobody can take it away. And if he feels that now my mission is over and it's time for me to go back home, then nobody will be able to save. So for heaven's sake, don't keep any security for my security. So that was his faith in God.
Wow.
And then he used to tell us also, whenever we were in his commune, we call it ashram. In our language, ashram is commune. Where his followers, and from that place, they used to lead a very sort of a simple life with principle, values, and some routine. Very good timetable. At 4 in the morning, everybody was supposed to get up. At 5, there will be prayers. And like that, the whole day. And there was 1 hour for the cleaning of the whole commune. Mm-hmm. He never employed anybody. And he used to say, hey, why not? There is nothing wrong if we have to keep our premises clean. And we have to do it. Why other person should do when we are using it? Even the toilets. And these days our toilets are as clean and good. And one doesn't feel that sort of... one doesn't feel dirty that we are cleaning the toilet. Mm. In those days, it was a very different story. Mm. I will not describe it.
Yeah.
But it was not a pleasant task. But even then, he used to insist. And first he would do. That is one thing which we have learned from him. And from, I think everybody will agree that whatever he preached, he practiced. Mm. And that is why his words had more weight.
Mm.
People used to follow. If he used to say, if I don't do it myself and I don't follow the rich, whatever my principles or values, then how can I tell the other person?
Hmm. Just a couple other questions, if I may, about your grandfather, Mahatma Gandhi. You've told us already so much about what he believed. It sounds as though he was largely a very serious person. Hmm. Was he also ever funny? Was he someone with which you could play or joke around? Did you see much of that side of him?
Somehow I can't tell you the example because I don't remember at the moment, but his sense of humor was immense. In the midst of the meeting, when they were discussing very serious things, nobody could think, but he will crack a joke and make the atmosphere very light. And I remember only one incident, but not it with me, but I'm told by others. See, he was, as everyone loves their children, not only us, but for him, he believed in world family. He considered the world is a family. My family consists of the world. Mm-hmm. In Hindi, in Sanskrit, which is our original language, they say, Vishwa Kutumbakam. Vishwa means world. Kutumbakam is family.
Hmm.
So he believed in that. So for him, he did pay attention to us. But to him, everybody, all children were equally, like like a son or a grandchild, like that. So once, and every time he used to play, whenever he had time with the small children, although in those days in the commune, there were not too many children, but it is a story, because somewhere he was, there were some children, they were laughing and playing with Gandhiji. And then they said, come on, Gandhi, Bapuji, as we call it, Bapuji. Bapuji in Gujarati means, it is again a respectable name for the father.
Hmm.
Bapuji means. So okay, Bapuji, let's have a race, running race. Yes, and you also join us. Then he said, okay, I'll join you. And then naturally, the children were very swift and they ran and little bit, he also must have tried to let them feel very happy. They defeated Gandhiji, Bapuji. So he did that way. And then children started saying, Bapuji, you lost and you can't compete with us and you can't defeat us. Then he said, yes, I do agree. You are so good, so energetic, and so fast. Okay, but now I will ask you something. Whether I can do, can you do that? The children said, okay, tell us. So he took out his denture. And he said, see, I can take out my denture and I can again fit it also. Can you do that? So whole atmosphere was, everybody was laughing and saying, they were amazed at the sense of humor.
That's the kind of thing we don't read in the biographies of your grandfather.
I know, these are the small things.
Usha Gandhi, granddaughter of Mahatma Gandhi, with her friend Prasad and a local activist by the name of Mike Frontier, a morning show from several years ago.